Timory Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember. Even with a busy speaking and radio schedule, she finds time to devote to her creative love of dance. Don Johnson is an author, speaker, and major motion picture film producer. Both hold master's degrees in theology, and together they cover the week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. From the Southern California studios of Relevant Radio, you're listening to Trending with Don and Timory.
We are unfortunately living in a more and more drug-addicted culture. Probably the most well-publicized epidemic is the opioid epidemic that we're going to talk about later in the show. Right. But first, though, a very interesting piece at the Huffington Post, one that I really related to on many levels and I found somewhat enlightening. And the headline was, America's Drug of Choice, It's Not What You Think. And they go down some of the common ones. Is it opioids, heroin, cocaine, tobacco? No, none of those things. Not even alcohol. This writer makes the case that America's drug of choice is sugar. What do you think?
It's not a big surprise to me. Maybe because I myself have struggled a lot with my health over the years and, you know, different elements of food and food allergies. I looked at this and I said, yes, it truly has become something that we are addicted to in many ways, but we don't realize because so many of our foods are fillers with it, something you wouldn't think that's super sugary, but that is.
That's something that I too have learned over the last few years as not only my kids, but my wife have had various food related health issues. Right. And also after I turned 40, the stereotype is true. I don't know what happens to your metabolism, but I found it much more difficult to stay in shape. I really had to like watch what I'm eating a lot more. Right. It was, you know, when you're young, you just pound back the donuts and it doesn't matter, you know, whatever. And now I'm like, man, what is going on here? I should not be this out of shape. I'm still exercising. And it really has to do a lot with your food. And that's when I realized, indeed, sugar is in everything, even like healthy looking foods,
right?
Not full of sugar.
That's why I always joke. People go, oh, do you shop at Whole Foods? I said, well, yeah, I do sometimes, but just because you shop at Whole Foods doesn't mean that that's good food a lot of the time. Because I think that as a whole, you know, the millennial generation, even the other generations, have gotten so used to sugars being in everything that we don't really notice when, say, you're just drinking what looks like a good, healthy coffee that actually has a lot of sugar added to it, or whatever it might be.
This article makes the case that sugar, instead of a food, which is, I think, how we normally look at it, right? Like, well, sugar is just another one of those food items that you put together when you're baking the muffins or the pancakes or whatever.
Right.
You throw some sugar in there, and that's what everybody does. They're saying, no, it would be better to look at it like a drug. And in fact, in the past, it was not considered a food or even a spice. It was looked at as a medicine. This was enlightening to me. And frankly, listen, I haven't studied all the rest of the history. I don't know if this author is exactly perfectly right, but what she says does make a lot of sense. For instance, in AD 500, for example, in India, they say it was used as a medicine for headaches, for stomach flutters, for impotence even. And over time, it became used as a gift. So it had these medicinal qualities, and it was this high quality thing, sort of like the oils. You know, you'd give frankincense, I guess, and maybe you'd give sugar as
right.
well. And over time, though, we've come to look at it as a food. But when you look at what it does to a body, it actually does have those same drug type things. It gives you that dopamine kick.
Yes.
In the same way that other drugs do.
Well, and I think that that's something that's really important. Any type of food in general, you know, our body kicks into the feeling side of the body of, hey, when I'm hungry, the body releases a little bit of dopamine, reminding you, hey, remember when you ate, you felt satisfied, it felt nice? You receive dopamine when you eat. That's why there's such thing as comfort eating, you know? But sugar has become something that we've so drastically, I think, chased after. And it's interesting because you have all of these psychologists and even obesity researchers who have shown that even rats, when rats are raised on sugar, will actually go to extreme measures just to chase after the sugar again for that dopamine kick, even going through tremendous pain in order to get the sugar.
Well, and I think about when we have sugars, and I think it's usually related to dessert. Now, I grew
right.
up in a culture where dessert, you always did have some sort of dessert for some reason.
You did or did not?
We did. And, you know, you always had the dessert. And when you don't have it, that even when you're full, you're like looking for that little piece of chocolate or something, right? Like you don't need it. But on the other hand, you do need it. Like it's not providing you nutrition, you're full, you're satisfied. Right. You don't need, you know, calories at this moment, but you need something that chocolate or whatever is providing, that sweets. And that's an interesting, it made sense to me now, like, oh, that's what I'm after. I'm after that little dopamine kick.
That little dopamine kick. Well, and even kind of a transitioning and making little changes, like maybe instead of eating sugar, a piece of cake, donut, have some fruit instead, because in fact, a lot of fruit is very, very high in sugar. My nutritionist, actually just a few weeks ago, so some people know I really struggle with autoimmune disease, I was telling her some of what I was eating and she started laughing at me. And she knows that I'm really good at following, you know, what I need to for my health. I said, what? She goes, that's a lot of sugar, Timory. Yeah. And I don't eat that much sugar, but it was just a couple of pieces of fruit that I had been throwing together, having every single day. And she said, you should maybe be having like a fourth of that a day.
I've noticed that, like making my smoothies and stuff.
Yes,
yeah, you can actually, you can get a lot of sugar into a smoothie with a few, you know, a few fruits. Now, something else about this article that really fascinated me that I hadn't thought of before. The author talks about a sugar culture that has grown up in our country and in Western society where sugar is related to celebrations. And so as part of a birthday party or whatever, or Christmas or thing, you know, whatever, It's not a party till the sweets come out, right? Or you're not going to have any sort of celebration unless there's some sort of sweet there. And this really made me think, like, yeah, there is a lot of social pressure and social traditions that go along now with sweets that are really very unhealthy. And it makes it very difficult for someone who is trying to eat healthier. Because I hope we can just admit, all right, whether or not you're a sweet addict or not, I hope we've seen the science enough now that we realize that too much sugar is not good for you.
Well, and I try to bring an element of faith into this. So for me, you know, struggling with food over the years now, I've had to change my attitude about when I don't know, even if I want to say make exceptions, but when I maybe enjoy food a little bit more, and I try to make it more so related to Sundays, a day of rest, a day of celebration, or maybe it's a really big feast day. I mean, there are tons of awesome feast days peppered in throughout the month, even JP2's feast day, which we'll talk about a little bit at the end of this show, and how these are opportunities to celebrate at the right moments with our food, but otherwise to look at food as a means of nourishment and not constantly a sense of pleasure. Because I know I myself, you know, when I started finding out I couldn't eat certain foods, I would get frustrated because I'm like, man, food isn't as fun. It's not as enjoyable. Right. It's frustrating. But what it came to teach me was that temperance, fasting, self-control, again, the right times to celebrate, actually had a big impact, not just on how I ate my food, but on my whole lifestyle.
Well, I totally agree. And I try to take a similar approach where, all right, I will have the apple pie on my birthday or whatever for a feast day. I really like that. The problem is, and this is something that you talk about in the article, that the social pressure to consume the sugar as a social thing is very high in our society. And I thought of this even just last week. So I'm at a church gathering where I'm the MC, and it's a church gathering where people come and they meet in groups. And one of the things that you could do as part of your group to be nice, you know, was to bring desserts. And this was the thing that they all, and so somebody brought a dessert. Well, at each table, basically. And I, as the MC, am put in this position where everybody was like, hey, look at this beautiful cake
Try
we
everything.
Brought, or this beautiful this, or this beautiful that. And I felt like I was personally offending every single person that came up to me, like, hey, we saved this just for you. And I'm like, listen, I worked out earlier today so I could burn off those calories. And now, and now you're just like, I'm going to offend you. And I do think it's something to take into account, like, how often is social pressure applied in our culture where we're actually sort of like, even if a person we know they're on a diet, like, here's a cookie or something, you know, and like, I don't know. I think we need to be more aware of that, maybe.
You know, what's funny is my friends who are on diets actually enjoy coming over to my house or going out to eat with me because I can't eat a lot of places, which is really frustrating. But I mean, it is what it is. And it's funny because that social pressure is so serious. Even when you have, like, you cannot eat certain things, people just think, oh, have a little anyways, just try it. But they don't understand what's done. When you have a severe food allergy, for example, But not even that. I know a lot of people who live very active lifestyles. Most of us do, who maybe don't have a lot of time where we're home and we can eat at home and maybe cook as much as we need to or take the time to. A lot of time that comes down to planning. But I think it's interesting because people can't respect, oh, I'm just going to have a soup and a salad. They want you to have more. They want you to indulge. Yeah. But some people can appreciate, I'm enjoying my time with you. I don't have to have something fabulous in front of me in order to enjoy that.
Right. And how much of the social pressure to consume sugar is responsible for the 70%? 70% right. of Americans now are overweight or obese. I mean, that is crazy. That's a crazy number. But you know what? I thought of this too in raising our kids. So one thing my wife and I have done since our first child was born, we go out to a fast food place and we just never buy the soda. We just never do. We never have. We just don't. For one thing.
We never did growing up either.
For one thing, it's way overpriced. It's just like stupid expensive for what you're getting. But the other thing is it's terrible for you, right? It's ridiculously bad. It's just straight sugar. Right. Well, the social pressure on my kids even. Yeah. And on us, when we, because you want to go out with other families after church, you know, you're going, hey, all the other kids have their big sodas. And we're like, sorry, kid. And we're like ostracizing our own kids. But that's a price that I have felt as a parent over the years in right. just trying to keep my kids healthy. Now, interestingly, a lot of the other parents since then have sort of taken our example and they're saving a bit of money and there's so
and
it's gone the other way.
So though, yeah. They're more strict about it because my parents were the same way. They were very careful with how much soda we had and wouldn't buy both from an expense perspective, but because it's just not good for you.
It just isn't. It's just terrible. So yeah, I feel like let's be more other oriented in our food choices and don't force that other person to have the brownie or whatever and maybe find something healthy to bring as an alternative.
Timmery and Don will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. And at Don Johnson Media. From the Southern California studios of Relevant Radio, you're listening to Trending. Trending. With Don and Timmery, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
So I think one of the big challenges today is this drug culture that we're facing. You know, we started the show talking a little bit about sugar and the impact on our diet, but also how, you know, the way we view sugar in food impacts the way we live. Well, similar with how we worship and the views that we take on the existence of our own lives and our relation to God really does, in fact, impact how we view drugs and different types of narcotics. And I think that a great example of this was discussed recently on the Daily Signal, where they compared two states, New Hampshire and West Virginia, one with a higher level of religious elements to the faith. People are practicing their faith and they have a very, very low opioid culture there. However, on the opposite side, you have New Hampshire, where it's well known that very few people practice their faith here, yet the drug culture is rampant.
Yeah, the correlation between the opioid epidemic and religious belief, and more importantly, even perhaps, how one can come out of that addiction culture has been explored recently in several studies. There was a family prosperity index done between 2000 and 2015. And here's what it found. New Hampshire's drug overdose rate increased by 724%, second highest during that time. And West Virginia's illicit drug use rose as a percentage by 2.5%, which was second lowest. And both of these cultures, I mean, West Virginia and that whole sort of Rust Belt region has been hit hard. I mean, the opioid epidemic is strong there. Mm-hmm. And you look at, well, what is it that helps people out of it? And you don't want to sound, it's very easy to get simplistic on this, and I don't want to sound mm-hmm. simplistic, either in talking about why people get addicted to right. opioids or how they get out of them. But I think we do know that at one level, there is a crisis of meaning that occurs in people's lives.
Absolutely.
That pushes them towards trying to find comfort, relief, just something to ease the pain somewhere else, including drugs. And a crisis of meaning is almost always associated with a lack of religion.
Well, and it makes me think, too, of the whole debate here in California. Welcome anyone who likes to smoke pot. Come on in, apparently, because we've legalized it. But a friend of mine, when we were talking about this, you know, me not being one who's ever smoked marijuana and yet having a lot of friends who years back did. And I remember talking to one of my friends and they were talking about how really marijuana is the drug of atheism in many ways, because they were talking about how when you have marijuana, you feel like a god, you feel fantastic, and how on a lower scale in comparison to other drugs, you don't feel maybe as high or as, I mean, entrenched in the drug as others, but that feeling that you experience, they would talk about how it makes you very much so divorced from God, and that you have, like, you are it. And I think that that's important to recognize, because then if you have a foundation that is not present and understanding more to the meaning of life, purpose, knowing whether or not you're loved unconditionally, I think that that makes a very large impact. And, you know, you mentioned earlier that, you know, we can't just oversimplify this and say it's just a matter of faith, because I've had very dear extended family members and friends who have struggled with extreme drug addictions.
Yeah, again, there's so many factors involved. I saw some crazy stats this week, Timory. There was a town, you know, last week I think we talked about some of the corruption at higher levels with some of the pharmaceutical companies paying off the politicians and the FDA and all that stuff. I saw some numbers. There was a town in somewhere in the upper Midwest there that it was a town of about 350 people. And over 2 years, they had 9 million opioid pills shipped to that town. 9 million.
Wow.
And because of the laws, it couldn't get regulated and all the rest of it. But you think, okay, right? Like, if you go to town flooded with 9 million pills, something is going to go wrong. And so there's, again, a lot of issues. One of the major ones, though, and again, we don't want to oversimplify, but the lack of religion and lack of purpose is often associated with a degrading of family life.
Absolutely.
And you talked about the loneliness and the, you know, I don't want to feel alone. I want to feel loved. Well, right. Primarily where we learn that is in our intact families. And the family breakdown, and I don't know, I don't see the stats here in this particular article, but I know the relationship between family breakdown and opioid use is through the roof.
Huge.
I mean, it's huge.
Especially for children who come from families of divorce.
Oh, absolutely. And that's what you see in some of these communities, is that whether or not they, you know, were historically church going, as the family has broken down, and that's usually closely related with not going to church anymore, that the opioid crisis then has arisen. And of course, economics plays a part too. Mm-hmm. The manufacturing jobs went away and more people got divorced and people stopped going to church, and it's a lot of factors. But one thing that we can know for sure is that faith can help you get out of that and keep
Absolutely.
You from getting that, getting addicted.
Well, it makes us ask a question for ourselves, for our children, future children, whatever it may be. What is our foundation that we have? And we talked a little bit about this on our show where we talked about lifestyle and a basically foundation. But whether it's drugs, it's alcohol, whether it's pornography, sexual addictions, are you forming in yourself and in others a foundation that's able to withstand all of the social pressures? Because you know what? I think that we don't realize what a strong impact this social pressure on drugs has really had on many people. It is so common. You know, where I grew up in a very small town, and the schools that we interact with and the friendships that we now have, where we know people used to be addicted to different forms of drugs, even if we consider them minor ones, or whether it's alcohol and pornography. This is a really serious question that we have to ask. Is our foundation strong enough to help us withstand everything that we're facing? And, you know, that's why we talk about these on Trending. We need to be aware and be engaged. You know, there's a story a little bit, and maybe kind of transitioning, talking about this. You know, I think about this because if we don't have a strong foundation, and if we are living these lifestyles open to drugs, pornography, alcoholism, we're living a lifestyle side by side with what we've seen happen over the last couple of weeks with Harvey Weinstein And this is really serious. And it kind of hit close to me recently because I know someone who was at a high school dance recently, homecoming dance. And there are a group of three friends. And one of the girls was kind of sitting off to the side while a not so nice young man ends up grabbing her, yanking her into the bathroom and starts attacking her. You know, we don't know exactly how far it is because often when girls are sexually assaulted, they cover it up. And so what we do know does sound more minor, but she was still violently attacked. And luckily, a security guard was able to step in and kind of ran into the bathroom and caught it. At what point, we don't know, but she was horribly attacked. And you know what ends up happening? A bunch of the teachers chaperoning the dance end up coming out and accusing her. Well, why didn't you run? Because he goes running and gets away. They know who it is, though. And you know, it's ridiculous because the teachers are looking at her, well, why didn't you run too? You got caught. And she's saying, no, like, I've been assaulted and attacked. And these teachers didn't even report it as a mandated reporters. And I'm just sitting here thinking, here's this poor little girl who actually knows what happened to her fully. Yeah. Here's this poor little girl. And what is her foundation that she is going to be able to withstand the pain of what she faced? And then you have all these people okay with any type of drug, alcohol, whatever it is. And we have these silent group of people. I just can't understand it. And that's why we've got to ask, what is your foundation to face whatever trauma you may endure in your life, whatever addiction you may be challenged with? Is it strong enough to face what we have to engage with in this culture?
The culture is toxic. It's just toxic. That's such a sad story. And it's just so irritating that the teachers would blame the victim first. And I feel like that's what we see all the time. I mean, we talked about it with the Me Too campaign and all that. I'm like, it doesn't matter. Even if there was some, you know, people who abused that Me Too, it doesn't matter. There are women who are getting abused. You have to be on their side first. Like, right. You have to be getting from their perspective what happened and coming alongside them. And you're right, Timory, that if you don't have that support. And again, I go back to the family. Like, the family's going to be the first and foremost supporter.
Absolutely.
When you face whatever you face. I mean, this is why God instituted the family, right? Like, when you go out into the world, and even now, like even kids growing up, I mean, I just think of my daughters. I mean, just the immense, and we're so protective, I feel like, but just the immense social pressure that they get right. from everywhere. We would literally have to cocoon them to pretend. It's just not possible. And right. it's just immense pressure. And that's why we work hard. And I feel like I fail every day, but you work hard on saying, this family is your first and foremost you know, shelter in the storm. Like, no matter what, we are here to support you
this
and be here for you.
System.
And beyond that, then, and this is what that article with the opioid crisis was talking about, beyond that, the church should be an extended family, right?
Yes.
And too often now, of course, the family itself is disintegrated, but even our church culture is not, you know, it's all like little, it's all broken up over our various arguments and stuff. Like, no, in our culture, when it's so toxic, we have to be that shelter in the storm.
Right. And that also puts pressure on us to make sure we are finding the church where we do have a community. Not that, you know, if people talk about church hopping, well, try to make your church that you are going to, your community, get involved, be supportive. Does the pastor know the different talents you have and the way that he could call on you if he needed to? Or are you participating in something, you know, not that we all have a lot of time, but in some way or another, how are we involved in supporting building a family in that church?
Yeah, it's a great question, especially as the culture becomes more and more anti-faith in so many ways. Mm-hmm. The more support you can have from like-minded, loving people, the better off we're going to be. You're not going to do well just like going out there on your own. You will be buffeted by the various winds, as the scripture says. And so, yeah, it's a great point, Timory.
Timory and Don will be right back. Tweet them at Timory. That's TIMMERIE and at Don Johnson Media. This is Trending with Don and Timory on Relevant Radio. To learn more about Don Johnson or Timory Millington, or to book either of them to speak, visit DonJohnsonMinistries.org or Timory.com. And be sure to share and rate the podcast of the show on iTunes.
I was listening to a show on the way into the studio today, Timmery, and they were talking about something they called toxic masculinity. The idea was...
Do you see me rolling my eyes right now?
I can feel it. I can feel the eye rolling. The idea was they actually shared some stories of some gentlemen as I don't know if it was part of their company or what this what the context was, but they had had to go to these meetings where they were informed about their toxic masculinity and how they shouldn't be doing those masculine things like, I don't know, I don't even know, probably opening doors for women and all that stuff. I mean, we don't want to do that. We don't want to do that, men. What you need to be doing is, oh, I know what they were supposed to do. They were supposed to get in touch with their feelings and be vulnerable and I don't know, wear pajamas and drink Coke. I don't know. I don't know exactly what they were supposed to do. I didn't want to know because I turned the station by that time because the whole masculinity is a serious deal. And the lack of masculinity, true, traditional, actual Christian masculinity, the lack of it, I think, is hurting our culture big time.
Absolutely. You know, kind of a funny side story, but my brother was talking recently about how he was at a dance and he ended up asking this girl out to dance. And, you know, I think it's something in high school that you don't see a ton of anymore because boys are so anxious. He's like, yeah, you know, he ended up slow dancing with her and enjoying his time. And in my mind, I'm thinking, yes, thank you. So many men would never even ask. But, you know, I think that a lot of men are afraid of being not even forward, but just being honorable and respectful and, you know, being willing to ask and initiate. I think that's the word I'm looking for. Initiate.
Yeah.
Men are now afraid to initiate because they've been hounded over and over again with a hammer saying it is not okay to be you. And to any man listening, I want to say it is okay and good to be you. But it's good to also be a good, strong, faithful man. And that makes you a better you.
Yeah, the term initiate, that's interesting because just this week I have been reading, and we have a story about him later in the show we keep promoing. I was reading some of the documents of St. John Paul II, our favorite pope, my confirmation saint, love the man. And he talks a lot about, this is why I was reading him. Of course, I'm doing the sexual revolution doc, but I was studying the feminist movement of the 50s right. and 60s. And he actually wrote a lot to women. And in that, he talks about masculinity and femininity. And one of the things he talks about, what it means to be masculine, is that just by the nature of it, men initiate. And he's talking about the language of the body. And you're like, you don't have to be, you know, Sherlock Holmes to see that bodies are different. And even the sexual act,
yes.
The man is the initiator. If you, I mean, I don't, we're not going to paint too clear of a picture.
But the second you say that,
I know,
that is sexist.
I understand.
That's
I understand.
The issue.
That's the problem, though.
Are you getting scared? Are you getting scared, Don? Are you worried? I'm calling you toxic. And
totally toxic.
Totally toxic.
But how that plays out, and this is why we've got actually an article from the Daily Wire that I thought was very good. How that plays out is not in being... mean and aggressive in a bad way, right? But rather, it is the opposite of what St. Thomas Aquinas calls effeminacy, right? To be masculine in the sense that you initiate is different than what Aquinas called effeminacy. And here's how Aquinas defines that. Someone who readily yields to the touch, who is ready to forsake a good on account of difficulties which he cannot endure. And so let me just paint a picture. So the bears rushing through the woods to attack the camping grounds full of women and children. The effeminate man yields quickly, runs away, and leaves the women and children to fend for themselves. He yields quickly to the touch, and hey, that doesn't look good for me, so I'm going to forsake a good on account of the difficulty that I might have in fighting that bear or whatever, right? The masculine man not only does not run away, but initiates an attack on the bear for however you're going to do it to keep that bear away from the campgrounds.
He steps away from his own pleasure. He steps away from his own safety in many ways for the sake of the other.
That's exactly what it is. It's love is what it is.
Right.
But it's a particular kind of masculine love, actually, that steps into the danger and steps into many other things in life, right?
Right. This makes me think, and I bring it up all the time. Remember that picture? I think maybe 1 or 2 years ago now, it was at a baseball game, and this ball came flying out into the stands, into the stadium, and it was about to nail this kid who wasn't even paying attention. He was looking down at something in his hands, maybe a phone or something. But what happens is you see in the picture, one of the dads just reaches his hand out and totally blocks the kid. A bunch of other dads you see kind of like moving forward, or other men, I should say, move forward to protect the kid. What are the women doing? The women are guarding themselves, hunching over, covering their faces and heads. There's not a single woman in that picture who is there trying to protect the boy. And I am not offending you, ladies. I am saying there's a difference in how we are wired. There's a difference in how we interact. And there's this initiation from the men that naturally, boom, kicked in to save that kid. Thank God. I mean, that could have done some serious brain damage. Who knows what?
Absolutely.
But it's a reminder that this initiation from men, good instincts from men need to be fostered. Our instincts aren't bad. It's when our emotions, our desires are out of touch with reality that they become not so good. And that's why, you know, we're looking at this piece. I love the title of this piece. When knights surrender their swords, beasts shall devour maidens. And this is exactly what we are seeing with the Me Too campaign, Weinstein. We're seeing it with other people in our culture who it is devastating that so many people have remained a silent majority, not a minority, a majority, because they're seeking fame, power, whether it's school teachers wanting to keep tuition, whether it's school teachers thinking that, well, you should be free because I want to be free to do whatever with my sexuality. We are justifying things. And in the meantime, people are becoming tremendously victimized.
Yeah, you think about all of our great stories, all of our great fairy tales. Really, any movie you want to look at where there's a male hero, what does the male hero do? And what does the bad guy do? I think of like even Titanic, you know, I assume we're familiar with the Titanic, and the weaselly guy gets into the lifeboat. I don't know if you remember at the end of Titanic.
I wasn't allowed to watch Titanic
growing
up. So haven't seen it.
The weaselly guy gets into the lifeboat ahead of everybody else and saves his own skin. Whereas the courageous guy sacrifices himself for the good of the other. And just like any, that's just any story, right? Like, think about the dragon is attacking the village. The man goes out. And if the man runs away, like the Weasley King, Lord of the Rings, have we seen Lord of the Rings? There's the Weasley King who runs away, and then they have to get his courage up, and he has to become a man again and go and charge forward and sacrifice himself. That's always the hero of the movie. Even in like cartoons, right? Like I think of what did we watch the other day? That Big Hero 6. Okay. The model for these Disney shows is always the same. At the end, the hero sacrifices his life so that others may live. That's how it works. Okay.
Well, and I was even thinking about this recently. So, secret about Tim Ray, I love to read fantasy. I love fantasy novels, and I had a list of nice books, you know, with knights and everything that a friend had given me, and I left it at work. And so one of my coworkers, I sent a message saying, hey, there's a list of names on the counter. Please don't get rid of it. And so I came back to work and I said, hey, you know, I said, thank you. Do you save the list? He goes, what is this? I said, I love fantasy books. And he makes like a weird face. And I looked at him and I said, not that kind of fantasy. Okay. And he goes, oh, okay. And he kind of corrects himself. But it made me laugh in one sense, and also kind of correct and think about it. You know, there's this element to stories that we love, this strength, this sacrifice. Knights have a tremendous amount of temperance. They have self-control. They have a boldness that is tempered in virtue. They are chivalrous. They have all these elements of courage. But at the same time, people, I think, have turned their version of fantasies not into something that is good and strong, but into something that seeks pleasure rather than seeking a good example of virtue.
Well, and we see this, and this is why this article was brought up, was the Weinstein thing. What you have is, of course, this lecherous old guy seeking pleasure by abusing women, as evil as it gets, right? Of course, right. We see that. But what the article points out is, around him, you had a whole bunch of other men who knew exactly what he was doing, but they would not be the knight. But rather, they were essentially the same as Weinstein because in order to protect themselves, my career, my own pleasure, maybe I'm doing something like that, whatever it was, I'm protecting myself, I'm looking after myself, rather than all those women that are getting abused, I'm not going to be the knight and rush in and sacrifice myself, because that's what would have happened.
Right.
They would have given up their careers, probably. They would have lost money. They would have all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. They're not willing to do that, and what that shows is they weren't knights, right? They weren't truly men.
I'm sorry, but you guys are a bunch of liars. You know, you act in these movies where at times, for example, I think of Ben Affleck, who his name has been associated with being one of the silent parties who knew what was going on. And I look at this and go, how can you get up there and be Batman, this image of protecting people and sacrificing for others? And it, I just look at it and I'm disgusted. You know, how can we actually sometimes watch movies now after knowing this scandal and know some of these people who didn't say a thing, but they falsely sit up there and act a part that is nowhere near
who
they are?
Maybe that's part of the thing, right? Acting, you know, is lying, essentially, right?
Like,
I mean, like, it's maybe that's part of the deal, is like we go out there, we put on a face, but who we are is different. I don't know. It's an interesting question.
But then we just become lousy. We hide behind whatever it is. And not saying that acting in and of itself at all is bad, but you know, you're up there acting these parts that you yourself have to recognize as a heroic person.
Yeah.
What are you doing to take on those attributes of the heroic person of the knight in shining armor?
Timmery and Dawn will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. And at Dawn Johnson Media. From the studios of Immaculate Heart Radio, you're listening to Trending.
Trending.
With Dawn and Timmery, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
Last segment, we were talking a little bit more about the Harvey Weinstein scandal. And one response that I found interesting comes from Matthew Walther at TheWeek.com. He just says, we need to do away with sex. Okay, he doesn't say.
So is he sacrificing himself here?
Yeah. Well, this is an interesting piece, and I don't know his background or what worldview he's coming from, but he suggests that as a culture, we have become simply too obsessed with the act of sex, and it's throwing everything off. He said, in the big scheme of things, and actually I'm going to jump to the end of his article because I thought this was actually pretty good. In the big scheme of things, at the end of your life, are you going to think about all of those minutes or hours or however long you spent rubbing meat against meat, I think was his term. And I'm sorry to get crass, but that's what it's... And actually, that's important. I say that because it's important to his whole argument. Are you going to think about that? Or are you going to think about the time you spent conversing with loved ones and spending time together with others, even doing creative work? I don't know if he mentions that one. But the other parts of your life, he says, ultimately, the sex part of your life...
Yeah.
You're giving it way too much credence. And at the end of your life, you're not going to look back on that particular mechanical act, whether it's you with the computer screen or you with somebody else or whatever, and think that it's that important. And as a culture, we've become so skewed because we think it's that important. I see some pros and cons to that argument. What do you think?
I think the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, if we have the right perspective on sex, you think about it, you have kids, a lot of people, I think of Joan Rivers, for example, who at the end of her life didn't say, I wish that I had more sex. It was that I wish I had more children, you know? And I think a lot of people, what are your most cherished moments? It's not having the sex. It's having had that child, seeing that little girl, that little boy grow up, spending and treasuring that time together. And that shows there's purpose to something. And that purpose gives things meaning. And, you know, the greater the end purpose, the end meaning is what we find more enjoyment and pleasure from.
Yeah, that's a great point. When we reduce sex to just that physical act, does skew how we look at it. And so actually, I see this from two ways. On one hand, of course, he's right in that sex in and of itself, the act, should not and usually does not take up that much of your life, right? Like in the big scheme of things, you spend more time at work, you spend more time eating, you spend all the more time doing all this stuff. And C.S. Lewis was actually pretty good on this. He said, there is a sense in which our culture, it's skewed in that I enjoy eating a hamburger or whatever, you know, I enjoy going out for a meal, but if I just had over my whole house just pictures of hamburgers and pictures of food and all of this stuff, like if that was just my obsession and I just thought about eating all the time, like, yeah, that's a problem, right? Like nothing wrong with eating, but when you're obsessed with it like that and you're like doing slow motion videos of eating and stuff, right? Like that's a problem. And
do you know that there are actually videographers that only film food?
It's interesting. He was writing in the 40s, right? And so it's interesting that some of C.S. Lewis, what he would use is trying to make a point. Like, it actually, we've become so pornographic. We've become right. so reductionistic in our culture that we actually have pornified food in many ways. We do have food weirdness.
Well, we willingly admit it. People hashtag food porn all the time.
Now, which leads to the other thing. Like, hopefully we can see that that's a problem. If we can't, here's why. Because we have such a reductionistic view of life. Like we actually do view life as just a big machine and we're just, you know, flesh machines inside of this machine. And the end of life, and by that I mean the overarching goal, like you were talking about, the overarching meaning of it, is just to have as much pleasure as possible. And hey, you know, that's very pleasurable.
Right.
And so therefore, that's what we're going to focus on. And not only that, we're going to focus on another highly pleasurable thing, eating. And so now we have this culture that is not only 70% of us are overweight and obese, but I don't know what the percentage is, it could be that high, have an obesity epidemic when it comes to sex. Mark Rignaris talked about this, right? Like we actually treat them in the same way, but it's because we don't understand what sex is.
Absolutely. Well, and that's where, you know, I just love St. John Paul the Great. His feast day was October 22nd. I was really bummed that it was on a Sunday. So, you know, Jesus' resurrection always takes precedence on Sundays. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, JP2, JP2. but it was so funny because I was thinking about this throughout the week and, you know, in light of everything we've seen with sexual abuse over the last couple weeks and the marriage culture, the lack of marriage, pornography, contraception. And it's a turn back yet again to St. John Paul the Great and his incredible work in Love and Responsibility and Theology of the Body. And just to throw this out there, if you haven't really looked a lot at his work, you know, they're tough to read. I will say that. But one awesome piece that I think is an excellent summary is Men, Women, and the Mystery of Love by Ed Suri.
Yes.
It is a fantastic short piece, discussion questions or questions for reflection. But as I think about his work, he helped young people, but also everyone now, I think, in really seeing that there's a purpose to the human body and that there's a theology even to our body and that what we desire on a physical level points to something so much more in the spiritual realm. Our lives, our bodies are ultimately made to be a gift. And at the heart of that sexual desire for intimacy is the human person. And at the heart of that is understanding that the person is an individual which we can only have an attitude that they are an end in and of themselves. They aren't a means to an end. And if we shift our focus going, well, what's the purpose of this sexual intimacy? Is it union and the good of the two people, or is it pleasure just for myself, right?
Yeah, if it is just pleasure, and that's a great summary, like either you're going to use the other person as an object for your pleasure, or you're going to treat them as they are, a creation made in the image of God, and the only proper response to that then is to give of yourself for their good. And the highest culmination of that between two peoples spousally is married sex, right? Like this beautiful image of man and wife giving of themselves to each other for each other's good. The opposite of that is to use a person as an object for your pleasure, which is what all illicit sex is and what we've reduced sex to in our culture. The irony of that is, I mean, there's many, but one of them is, as the writer of this week article points out, and he's advocating, if you're just joining us, he's advocating for the end of sex. Like, can we just not think about it anymore? He says, for him, it's just a tired concept that sex is dangerously and increasingly boring, he says. And actually what you're finding is millennials actually have far less sex than their predecessors did.
They're not getting married. Their libido is decreased because of hormonal contraception, erectile dysfunctions from pornography, you name it.
And it's because it has not, it's not fully sex.
We've cheapened it.
Yeah, you've cheapened it so much that they no longer even desire it. Like, right. Do it. Whatever. It's just boring. It's just like something we don't need. Japan, if you want to look at the end of our whole logical thing, you look at Japan. And Japan, you have like 35-year-old virgins who basically exist on porn and sex dolls. And it's becoming not to get crag in, but this is the end of it. Like, you end up with no relationships and actually no sex.
Right.
When you reduce sex to just this mechanical notion. I was watching the video. Don't ask me what. Well, actually, I was doing research. So why am I watching Ariana Grande videos? Because I'm doing research for this documentary.
Right.
Ariana Grande, as it turns out, very popular if you're not familiar with her. Every single song and every single video is about not love, but the physical act of sex. So her one video is a bunch of barely dressed women on bicycles. This is not even a PG-13, so I'm sorry, we should have warned you, but the song is called Side to Side. Okay, you get the idea. They're on bicycles. Don't watch the video.
Don't even think about it. Facebook livers can see our facial reactions and faces here.
And you're watching this, you're like, this girl, and she's, I don't know, she's not old, she's probably barely out of her teens, has so reduced the human experience to basically her riding a bicycle is how she views life now.
Right.
And it's just so sad to me. Like, oh my goodness, like, what are you doing?
Why has she done this? Because she has been reduced.
Yeah.
People have reduced her. Women have allowed themselves to be reduced. Men, and we don't talk about this enough, men have allowed themselves to be reduced from something less than who they are on both sides. And I actually think that we don't talk about that enough. You know, you want to be a knight. You want to be that person that's protecting women. Don't reduce yourself.
Yeah, you know what? And part of that is don't give in to that cultural thing that says, you know, real men go out and just have as many sexual partners as they can, or treat women like that, or look at porn, or all of that stuff. I mean, we've talked at length in the past few weeks about some of the things, frankly, that women can do, right? And to not cheapen themselves and sex.
Right.
But men, just stand up and say, listen, I don't need you to, I don't want you to look like that, right? Like, I'm not going to ogle you. No, if enough men just stood up and said, we're not going to be reduced to this thing, we could turn this thing around. Maybe.
Well, it was funny. I was speaking at a church just a couple weeks ago, and I was supposed to be speaking just to the girls about clothing and modesty, and they decided last minute to have all the little boys there too. And I thought, I just apologized to the boys. But you know what was interesting is the boys were almost more engaged than the girls were. And for anyone who knows me, I love clothes. I dress, you know, grew up in Southern California. But the boys, it clicked to them. They understood the concepts in a respectful and loving way, and they were interacting more than the girls were in many ways. And it was interesting because it was something actually that ended up being a good thing. These young men are growing up and are strengthened to recognize there's a respect I can have for you and expect of you in a way that says I love you and the person you are.
This has been Trending with Dawn and Timmery on Immaculate Heart Radio.
Trending.
To learn more about Dawn Johnson or Timmery Millington, or to book either of them to speak, visit dawnjohnsonministries.org or timmery.com. And be sure to share and rate the podcast of the show on iTunes.